This is Geek Speak, episode 38 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer, pedant, curmudgeon, and political junkie. We also have Mr. Brian Young. He's an iOS developer, designer, and software conference producer. Hey, Miles, recently we hit a milestone in historic game development. Can you tell us a little about it?
They have remade Doom this year to have much nicer graphics. Even though some of the rooms are exactly the same as they were in the original Doom, they paid homage to it.
Oh, cool. Doom, of course, is one of the first person shooters, and it was pretty impressive when it first came out. I remember just running around the rooms.
Yeah.
Killing Nazis.
It was not 3D. It was 2.5D.
And this was after Wolfenstein, right?
Yes.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
No, I say
and there was another one
the
before
thing.
That, which
really?
No one knows.
Oh, I remember Wolfenstein. Wolfenstein is one of the Nazis. Not
yep.
Doom. Sorry.
Yes.
My Leben.
But they already remade Doom like 10 years ago because I bought my PowerBook 17 so it could run that.
Well, there was like Doom 2, Doom 3, but they have released a Doom that is a remake of the original.
Okay, so they remake the original and then the graphics are just like stellarly better? Or
yes. It is a new benchmark for games, I guess, in some ways. ID has always been good that way, always been on the forefront. What was interesting about this, and this is for all the folks out there who wonder how a game like this gets made, how it's made so visually stunning. So what this person did on their blog was they took Doom, they took a screenshot or a snapshot in time.
Okay.
And then started to go back and reverse engineer, like look at the state of memory within the GPU.
Analyze it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so starts taking stuff about it and also looks at different data that's been gleaned over from a variety of sources. And so when they're analyzing this one frame, this is analyzing a 16 millisecond period of time. In other words, if the game is going at 60 frames per second, 16 milliseconds equals one frame.
Sure.
16 point something.
Yeah.
And so it goes through all of the different things that would happen on his, for example, a GTX 980. With settings all on ultra. And
well, what kind of stuff is he able to figure out from the memory dumps?
He's able to find textures.
Oh, cool.
128 by 128 so textures.
Miles now showing us a image texture map of all of the assets of the game, which is pretty cool.
Up there. Then it talks about shadow maps, they're put into – no, shadow map.
Shadow map. Yeah. Okay.
And you know, how they do depths, like how it looks before and after processing. And that things
cool.
getting layered one on top of another, and you're seeing all the different steps, and you start getting really self-conscious about your own programming ability.
Well, that's one of the things when Doom first came out, what John Carmack was able to achieve on the computers at the time
right.
was really impressive.
Right, especially back in the day because computers at the time were 386s.
Yeah.
386SXs as well. That pointedly, we don't think about it today, but at the time, it was not normal to have a dedicated floating point coprocessor.
Right.
Or
yeah,
floating point processor. Well, actually, we call them coprocessors at the time because they were this extra processor that you could add to the board after the fact. But you just had integer units. You didn't have floating point. That had to be simulated in software and were thus much slower.
And you needed, of course, floating point to do what he was doing.
Right. Well, so, yeah.
I also heard that Carmack wrote this all in assembly. That's how he made Doom function.
A lot of things were done in assembly, but it was a great deal was in C.
So Doom was considered one of the pioneering first-person shooter games. I'm reading Wikipedia. Introduced to IBM-compatible computers featuring such as 3D graphics, third dimension, spatiality, network multiplayer game, and supported a full player-created modifications with the Doom WAD format.
WAD files.
And since the release of Doom in 1993, the series has spawned numerous sequels, expansions, blah, blah, blah. We've played some before together. Since its debut, over 10 million copies of the game Doom series have been sold. Additionally, John Carmack is currently the CTO of Oculus.
I think it's the CTO position.
Yeah.
And works on Rockets.
and works on rockets.
Oh, is he on rocket science? So he's a rocket scientist.
So awesome.
Well, just to give you a like a comparison, back in 94, that was when I was in the computer lab all the time at school. And on one machine, we're playing on the SGI, we're playing Doom. And on the other machine, we're rendering out the frames for our 3D animations that we're making. So Doom, you call it 2.5D, and you're getting were we getting 60 frames per second back on the machines like that, or is that that's probably more like
you needed
20 to 30.
A 486 like DX266 or something like that to get full frame rate, but yeah.
And some hope.
Yeah, I was getting approximately 5 hours a frame
on your rendering
on my rendering. It would take 5 hours for it to calculate that one frame. Of course, the graphics.
Do you have some video from that time?
Yeah, well, it's on DAT tape.
Oh, no. That's horrible.
I keep meaning to find
something
to read.
You got
to
get that off, yeah.
I know.
It's funny when you talk about that because I remember a stat talking about the movie The Hobbit or The Desolation of Smaug, and it brings up Smaug. Each of his scales was one core week of rendering.
A week for a single core to process, for a single frame.
Yeah.
And that's a 3D film so that you had two frames per frame or two eyes per frame.
But of course, you had a server farm, and it rendered everything much faster than that. But at the same time, each scale was at that level.
It's crazy.
I wonder if they're doing pre-computing somehow. You know, you can pre-compute a scale, and then that can be reuse that data over and over.
But
if
you want to know what goes on behind the scenes to these games, whether or not you like the violence or not, this is the article to go to.
And we'll have that up at geekspeak.org, of course. Miles, you and Ben in my life, and actually on GeekSpeak, have both referred to the price of things in the metric of how much a burrito costs.
I have never done such a thing.
You have totally done that.
I challenge you to prove it. Find an episode where I did that.
There's thousands of hours of GeekSpeak. I don't have time to find that.
Can we run it through Google and get a transcript?
Yeah, Miles, can we? Okay. Ben very much has done this. In fact, we did this recently on a show. There was discussion of how much something costs, and he was using burritos as the metric of how much something costs. You used to do this to me.
No. Because,
yes.
No.
When you ate only burritos and you were in college and you and I were hanging in Santa Cruz, you'd be like, dude, I can't afford that. It's like three burritos. You totally did that. We weren't necessarily on air at the time, but I remember that pretty clearly. You like had this metric. You're like, a burrito is all you need, all the food you need for a day.
Obviously, you didn't get the nourishment to remember these things.
That's right, because you're only eating burritos. Life was horrible. Anyway.
Super mole.
Douglas, one of our listeners, said, since you still price things in burritos, you'll enjoy this, and gave us a link about a Bloomberg article about Alphabet, the parent company to Google, of course, and Chipotle. They're bringing burrito...
Chipotle.
They're bringing burrito delivery drones to campus. Yay. Isn't that sound like a great idea, you guys? These are drones that have wingspans. They can hover and also fly relatively quickly. And they are going to be running a program where they deliver at Blacksburg, Virginia.
Blacksburg.
A burrito delivery service to dorms and to students, college students. So you can get your burrito delivered by drone.
So from what I understand, they have a little winch system that lowers
the drone down.
So how do they know which person is to receive that burrito?
I don't know. I would assume that you say the location via phone and it comes to you and then it lowers a burrito. And if you get it, you get it, you know.
What are you talking about? College students? Food?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't the honor system work here?
Well, I want to know like why a college student wouldn't grab the tether and just pull the drone down and sell it for parts. I mean, it seems like a pretty expensive thing. Of course, cameras will be going the entire time and recording you, so I'm sure there'll be lawsuits regarding that. It's the first time that we're actually out there delivering stuff to people who want the stuff via drone, is the quote from Dave Voss, who heads up the Project Wing, is what it's called. As stupid as this is... I would totally work on that project. I mean, it sounds like fun, figuring out how to like safely, but also like how do you keep the heat in the burrito? I mean, it kind of does that itself.
Oh, it's got a mass that holds in the heat.
It's got to have
enough.
Like a little
aluminum foil.
Got to have like a little car. No, yeah, but you're going to be
flying.
The
magic of aluminum foil.
You're going to be flying it through the air. It's like buying a burrito at a shop and then going on a bike ride and just holding it in the air for 3 miles, right? That would get cold. You have to insulate it in some way. Not so much?
Yeah, you're right.
Anyway, it's also going to be taking off from a food truck. So there'll be like a food truck that comes locally and it will deliver from the food truck. And of course, the food truck will probably be human beings and they'll be like loading these things. And so I'm sure it will be very inefficient.
Oh, I have this new delivery idea. A food truck comes to an area and people walk to it.
That is great.
But then you don't get the effect of these buzzing flies around the food truck.
I also love the idea that, like, you're on campus, a food truck's on campus, but you're not going to have to walk to the food truck. You just have to stand outside your door and make sure you're not under a tree, and then you get a burrito.
Dude, we have been promised that there's going to be a taco, you know, a taco truck on every corner. Why do we need the drone to take the extra
last
mile?
Why have we been promised about taco trucks on every corner?
We were told by Trump that.
Oh, really?
I didn't hear this. A taco truck on every color, on every corner.
This is a bad thing?
Exactly. That's what people were saying. Like, what?
See, people have delivered tacos in, like, hackathons via drone. But I've never understood the desire of that. Like, a taco is not something you deliver by itself. A taco is part of a meal. It's not the meal. A burrito can be a full meal. You're not here with me on this, man? You know, Brian, when Miles and I first met, he has just been on the hiring committee to hire me as a UI engineer. And this is in like 98.
And I've been regretting it ever since.
He's in like 98. We worked in Burbank. And I do the interview and everything. And then within the first week, I'm meeting people and stuff. And Miles and I start talking about Santa Cruz burritos. Because I've moved away from Santa Cruz. He's moved away from Santa Cruz. And we're both kind of missing Santa Cruz burritos. So one time I'm like, you know, I'm going up to Santa Cruz this weekend. He's like, I'm there. Let's go.
Which is hilarious because we live in L.A. at that time.
I know. Aren't they supposed to have better ones?
Of course there's better burritos in Los Angeles. Absolutely.
Okay. Speaking of better burritos, there's a reason why this must be going on in Blacksburg, Virginia.
Why?
I grew up in Virginia. There is no good burrito in Virginia.
Ah, so they targeted the location
that
needed
burritos. I can attest to this when I went to go visit. Yeah.
So, of course, they're going to try it out there because what can you lose?
Fair enough. Brian, it's your turn. Let's talk about software revolution, shall we?
So software is revolutionizing everything. And I was looking at these two stories. They're a perfect bookend for what can go terribly right and terribly wrong. So did you hear about this new company that is starting up that their whole mission is to fund legal lawsuits based on their big data analysis on whether they might make money off of investing in your lawsuit?
Whoa. Investment in lawsuits for money return.
Exactly. So they have a bar of which they judge a potential lawsuit that they may want to help fund.
What kind of lawsuits are we talking about? Any kind of lawsuits? Or is it specifically technical related?
No. It's tort related lawsuits.
What the heck is tort? Wait a second. Hey, Pedant, what's tort mean?
Well, Brian's the one who looked it up earlier.
Yeah, whatever, dude. You're supposed to know these things.
I'm still trying to understand it.
Isn't that like something you put a fruit on and you eat at a party? That's tart.
Yeah, it is a theft.
A theft?
Yeah.
Any kind of theft? Let's read that. Let's go ahead and read it.
A theft that's outside the realm of a contract.
So if I were to take your broken laptop, that would be it.
My laptop's not broken. It's just tattooed.
Extra screen tattoos. If I were to take some physical object of yours, that would be – and you sue me for it? That would be a tort? Or, I mean, aren't I just breaking the law in general if I steal something? Is this where you take it to court because you claim
it? It doesn't go into criminal law until it goes up past a certain point, but yeah.
Mm, interesting.
Yeah, so a wrongful act of or an infringement on a right other than under contract leading to civil liability.
Okay, so it's not a theft. So it's more broad. It's just a wrongful act.
A wrongful act. So what this company does is they looked at a problem, which is that a lot of companies just don't have the money to pursue a lawsuit when it's some sort of smaller or even a big – yeah, even big claims. They just don't have the money to pursue a lawsuit. So they decided they're going to analyze cases and they're actually going to fund the ones that they think they're going to be able to make money back on. So a case that might cost them – their analysis would cost them maybe between $50,000 and $500,000 to pursue. Mm-hmm. As long as they think it can potentially reward them $1 million or more, they will offer the organization to fund their lawsuit.
This sounds horrible.
It's terrible. I mean, computers can do so many things, and software can do so many things, and you can solve so many problems in the world. I guess we had to go here, but no.
I don't know. It seems to me that there is a place where this makes sense, right? I mean, if you as an individual are wrongfully – something wrongful happens to you and you have to try to sue a corporation and they have lawyers on hand, you're not going to win that case unless somebody can take it. Normally, you go search for a lawyer and some lawyer will go, oh, this looks like a payback. I'll volunteer my time. But it's a very different success rate than going, oh, we'll invest a whole bunch of money and get a whole squad of lawyers to take on your case. So from that perspective, as the plaintiff, it does seem to make sense that you might want that ability. It just seems like that ability has already been there by finding a large law firm that might listen to you.
Well, that's just it. This is where the same thing of ambulance chasers comes from and that kind of thing. Are you a truck driver that's been injured on a
right,
road?
Totally.
So it's not like this mechanism hasn't existed there in some way before. But they're just taking it to a new level. But I mean, really, does our legal system need to be big data analyzed and only those cases in which somebody could get enough reward be tried? Shouldn't the law be based on what's right and wrong more than just what the financial gain could be?
Yeah, I mean, lawsuits don't work that way. Civil suits don't work that way, though, right? Because there's a dispute whether there's even a crime.
Right.
So it's hard to say, well, we're going to investigate anything that might be a crime. You've got to put some kind of barrier there. I definitely understand it. The company does seem a little creepy.
So bookending that is, do you remember the creator of the service that would dispute parking fines? He made a chatbot that you could talk with the chatbot that would allow you to answer some questions, and he would legally help you dispute traffic fines or
really?
Parking fines.
I don't remember this at all.
Although I believe we covered this.
Okay, I believe
a year or two ago. And I believe that was in San Francisco. This is a Stanford student who produced this chatbot service. Well, he started to expand it to other issues besides just parking tickets, but he kept noticing different responses that were related to homelessness. And so what he did was he took a look at the issue of homelessness and the issue of people not having any recourse when they're about to become homeless. And back in his native UK, he worked with some lawyers, and he's put together a service that helps people to find services and find ways of not becoming homeless when they're on the verge of it.
Oh, cool.
So here's a totally different problem, a totally different legal issue where somebody's writing software that is helping people. So this is a 19-year-old college grad, or actually I don't believe he's graduated from Stanford yet. And he gathered data through the UK's Freedom of Information Act and analyzed what claims or what legal claims would produce results, and is able to have a chat conversation with somebody. They answer the questions and they will get advice, legal advice on what they should do. Maybe it's, I think the most common one is to write a letter to the local authority.
Mm-hmm.
And this produces the results that they often get resources to prevent them from becoming homeless.
Very cool. Here's an example. So it's Joshua Bowder, and the first app, the chat app, is called Do Not Pay. And here's an example. I was evicted from my housing, and then this is the bot. The government must help help if you are legally homeless and meet certain conditions. Would you like to get started? Sure. Let me ask a few questions to see if you are eligible. Do you have a legal right to live here? Answer: I think so. So it's like it's a conversational way of kind of filling out a form, effectively,
yeah,
and doing the research. So that's really kind of cool. And I didn't know this was a college student that did this project. Very neat.
Now it's pretty funny. It's going through a bot. I mean, we talked about this before, whether that's the right interface for different problems.
Yeah. This does seem like a good one, that there's an artificial intelligence pattern to this, in the sense that you've got to fill out this data. There's all these questions. They're relatively English, but depending on the branching form, it can get longer or shorter. And understanding all of the idea behind the, you know, fill in a form question is hard, but structuring it like a conversation is actually not that hard to do. So it's neat. It's, it seems like a perfect pattern for this.
Yeah.
Yeah, really neat. Thanks for bringing that up to us. Miles, tell us about Facebook.
Facebook has been struggling recently with their curation and analysis of material. For example, there's been a longstanding battle that people have had with regard to for example, nipples, you know, male nipples, perfectly okay to show on Facebook. Female nipples, no, they get you banned.
Unless you're breastfeeding, which is, and then it's okay again.
But then you don't see the nipple, you're seeing the baby
No, you could be close to, you know, breastfeeding. And that's okay.
Okay, wait a second. Is this Facebook's problem or is this society's problem? This is just a reflection of our social...
See, here's the thing, though. Because we have always accepted, for example, pictures where there is a social service along with that photo.
Example?
An example of this would be this was put into a newspaper, and the newspaper's presence on Facebook, it's a Norwegian newspaper, talking about six photographs that have changed the world. One of them was a picture of the My Lai Massacre in Vietnam.
This is the children like running away from a massacre.
Yes,
and they're
including a nine-year-old girl who is nude because she was heavily burned, clothes burned away. And because of that, it broke Facebook's guidelines of saying you cannot show, you know, exposed genitalia, bare female breasts,
okay,
even though she's nine.
So does this kind of – there's two conflicts here, right? A social understanding that being aware of this kind of massacre is extremely important. The photograph brought people's awareness to serious issues. It can be powerful and motivating and is important change. And then the concern about their nudity policy.
Yes.
So those conflict because, of course, Facebook also wants those important news stories to be shown. They want to be a news central location. So what did they take down that news story?
They took down the news story and they suspended the reporter's account before he could respond.
So do you know?
So the Norwegian newspaper then came back and totally took Facebook to task. And since then, Facebook has reinstated the photo and reinstated the account. But
so do you know, is this a automated algorithmic process or is there some sort of editor or flagging system that caught this? I mean, when I say flagging, I mean a human flagging this as a
Well, I'm sure there are algorithms to try to get
closer.
Yeah, get closer. But then you need to have a human being.
An algorithm couldn't figure out if this was a boy or not. And so that's the nipple thing because this is a young child, right? It's not even there's no breast development there. And also if it was an overweight man, it would look like breasts to a computer. So that I don't think we have that level of artificial intelligence in image detection to actually be absolutely sure to be able to take action, if you will. I think it's flags up to a person and the person makes a decision. I mean, is that your assumption too, Miles?
Right. At the same time, I still think that it's ridiculous. I've seen examples online where they have a woman who was topless, like, and then they cut out her breasts and they put an overweight man's breasts on top of it, and it suddenly becomes okay.
Yeah, that's crazy. There's Colbert does a great little skit about drawings and inappropriateness, and he like I can't remember that he draws, but it could look like a penis if it didn't have eyes or something like that, right? And so if you look at it, it looks like a penis, and then you put eyes on it, looks like a face, and then you cover the eyes up, it looks like a penis, right? And so the NBC that he's on or CBS, I can't remember.
CBS.
The network is blurring the image when he has his hand covering the eyes. When he moves his hand away, they show the image. He covers it with his eyes. And it's like ridiculous. Oh, that's right. It was breasts and a face. You know, like there was mm-hmm. things that could look like breasts or eyes, and there was a mouth underneath it. That's what it was. And he was covering that up. Anyway.
The fact that they blurred that out just makes the message so much.
It's beautiful, right?
Yeah,
it's so ridiculous
poignant.
That we do this. At the same time, how do you deal with the concern about – I mean there is a line on what you want to see in your newsfeed, right?
Well, that's the thing though is people see things in their newsfeed they don't want to see all the time. I saw what amounts to snuff films of black people on my feed auto-playing
You're talking about for a while. Police shooting
yes.
black people.
And
that shows up on your feed.
I absolutely didn't want to see that.
Right.
But at the same time – we're talking about this prudishness we have about the human body. Now, if someone is posting photos of children nude in exploitive ways,
yeah,
like the exploitation
I mean,
is the issue.
Wait, first
not
of all,
the nudity.
That picture of that 9-year-old burned and running down the street is exploitive of her.
But
it's taking advantage of her pain and agony to motivate people's – I mean that totally is exploitation.
And it has a cultural context. The cultural context makes it allowable for us because it was a historically important event.
And it's benefit – I mean her being used in that way is benefiting her to some degree. It represents her in a good way. It doesn't demoralize her or anything, but it does take advantage of her situation and take advantage using that photo. So it is. It's just that what you disagree?
The photo is not intended to titillate, which is one of the issues.
Of course not. But do you think that the nudity thing is about titillation?
about sexual abuse, yeah.
Or
fomenting and encouraging and allowing to profit from
sexuality.
Abuse of children.
Well,
yeah.
Okay, that's the legality aspect. But Facebook's thing is not necessarily about children naked, right? It's about anybody naked.
Yeah,
prudes in general, right? They want to abide by the general consensus of our society that showing a breast is inappropriate ever, unless there's a baby suckling at it. And then even then it's questionable for some people. So
everyone outside of our liberal bubble here, yeah.
Exactly. the non-fathers in that we know, right? So Facebook's recant on this, but their problem is serious. Like, how do they resolve this? What do you think they should do? Make better judges? I mean, someone has to come down and make the decision on what image is titling and what image is not, or what image is appropriate and what isn't.
Well, yeah, but that's the thing, though. The question is not being made based upon that. The question is being made based upon human anatomy.
And gender.
Well,
and gender.
Or assumed gender.
What was the court case about pornography and the...
I'll know when I see it.
Yeah, that was the final comment. So, this is a judgment call. It takes judgment to do this. So if you're going to automate this process or use people that are not in the cultural context of the viewers, you're going to make mistakes. Just absolutely are.
And I would argue that this concept of a cultural – of the observer, when you're talking about Facebook is a global entity.
Right.
So you have to then make assumptions of what region you're in or what kind of person
it is. The thing is
– And there's no way to assume that.
Yeah,
you know?
I call BS on that.
How?
Because we have already seen – examples where if you are politically liberal versus politically conservative, you get a drastically different feed from Facebook.
Uh-huh.
They can identify the information. They can identify people that are more prudish versus not.
That's a good
absolutely
point. So basically
the
people that are more
problem.
Prudent don't see any nipples at all, male or female. Just doesn't happen on their feed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Facebook helps isolates us even more. It'd be great. I mean, that's
people
the
stay in
there,
their
right?
comfort zone with regard to that. I mean, if with regard to comfort zone, I would prefer that because that has to do with personal behavior, not with regard to enforcing what other people are doing. That's enforcing what you yourself are exposing yourself to. I may not agree with it, but then again, I expose myself to different things and have different limits than other people. That's my decision. My issue is making that decision for others.
Yes, but
as long as someone isn't being ostensibly hurt by it.
But keep in mind that feed separation that exists by their algorithms because of our interest and therefore what we get shown is completely their decision on how to do that. So they're already making that decision for us.
Yeah.
That's a problem, right?
That's the question of whether or not what you choose to see. Because right now, I'll be honest, Facebook is not a news gathering forum. I and others try to make it that way more often, but it's very much what can get people to go there, and that is basically entertainment.
What titillates them mentally?
Well,
what gives them pleasure or motivates them to put eyeballs on?
To keep looking, yeah.
So I heard this interesting discussion about this topic about whether Facebook is a media company. In other words, should they have editorial say over what gets published on their service? So you would say absolutely they should, or that they shouldn't?
Well, I think that should be I believe they should, but I think they should make it transparent as to it's being done. I don't know that people are necessarily upset that their feeds are giving them information that is curated to be to their liking. But I think people did have a problem with, wait, I didn't know that you were siloing the liberals versus the conservatives. I didn't know that you were siloing this group of people versus that group of people. I want to know what silo I'm in. I want to know so that I can choose to take a peek around the corner.
Mm-hmm. That's funny. I was just trying to do that before the show and I wasn't able to. I know there's a way on Facebook that you can look up what they think your political affiliation is. So that you can see which silo you're in. You're supposed to be able to do it on iOS. I wasn't able to make it work. You're supposed to be it on the web. I can't find it.
So the idea that you're in a certain silo, though, with a large algorithmic system is not – it doesn't translate that way, right? I mean, we can think, oh, you're liberal or conservative. But in reality, the algorithms are not doing that at all. The algorithms are assessing every individual and every file, everything that gets shown, and figuring out the best solution. Well, and it does not mean that Miles and I, because we're relatively the same, you know, bent, see the same stuff. It's more granular than that. Everybody sees something unique.
Yes, but the because we are not all unique snowflakes, as much as we would like to believe that, there is the ability to go back and look to see what divisions are being made. It's much like you can't see when does a species diverge to become two species. Sure. People have done it, but it's very rare and it's hard to do. And there's,
so when
there's
my
always...
stories and your stories can't mate any longer, then we are not in the same silo.
But it's sometimes very easy to look back in the fossil record and say like, oh, hey, here's where the branch occurred. That is, after the fact, we know that it's important to us. That's what I say. Like, they can go back and they can look to see, oh, this is a liberal silo versus a conservative silo. Not necessarily that the decision being made in the moment, which is being made by machine learning, is something that we would see,
right,
or recognize.
I agree that you can classify groupings retroactively, but the algorithms are not designed to be doing specific ideas of what we label as classifications. But in any case, you definitely could say, hey, what's the stuff that could be shown to me by my friends that I don't – would that you're not surfacing to me, right? That would mm-hmm. be a way to say there's more behind the covers. Do you want to involve yourself in other things? And they could make an interface to that. Of course, their motivation is for you to keep reading and keep engaging. And if you get ticked off by your Uncle Sam who's, you know, talking about something completely diametrical opposed to you, you're going to – get off the service and go for a walk. And that's not what Facebook wants.
Yeah.
So it's not, there's no benefit to them. And then the question about, like, Brian kind of started this by saying, should we give them the same rights as like a media company? I think that the concept of having, you know, newspapers have editorial and news carrying ideas, that was given to newspapers specifically because they were the medium of expression and the medium of data transfer in a private space. Facebook is completely that. Like, there's no way to say that they're not that. I don't think there's any
argument. And just like our news nowadays, it's become as much about entertainment as anything else. So there's that blurry line as well.
Thank you, Fox News. So I do have to amend my statement, which was I was saying I didn't have a problem with the siloing as long as you knew about it. I do have a problem with the siloing. I don't have a problem with Facebook doing what they're doing. I have more of an issue with the fact that we are uncomfortable keeping close ties with friends that disagree with us. That is the much larger thing, and Facebook is a reflection of that division.
How so?
If you look at your friends in your list, you know, how many of them are diametrically opposed to you in terms of belief or vote? In your case, how many of your friends vote Republican?
You're assuming that I'm voting a Democrat?
Yes, I'm assuming you're voting Democrat, yes.
I would say that probably 30% or more. It's a lower percentage, but there's, you know, there's 1,000 people that are connected to me on Facebook, right? And some of those people I went to school with, and some of those people I worked with, and I lived in LA for a while, so there's a lot of conservative people that I know. But I don't see their stuff nearly as much.
Okay.
There's always Brian's dad, you know.
Yeah, and there's all the friends I know from back east.
Which then gets into, on Facebook, we have a whole bunch of friends that we don't necessarily interact with, you know, that are there that we see things from time to time. But in general, we're looking at the stuff that's of our close family,
yeah.
our active close friends right now.
Yeah, what you're saying basically is the people you're going to interact with the most are kind of like the people you're going to interact with in real life. And those people have similar views to you, or if not, you would have deviated a while ago.
Right.
What are you showing us, Brian?
Okay, so I did find the page where it shows you your interests, including it is claiming I'm extremely liberal, among all of the other affiliations.
So this is interests, and you can search on Facebook probably for interests or something?
So it's actually a part of your ad preferences
uh-huh.
settings.
Cool.
And it shows the –
Can we share some of your stuff?
Yeah,
read
you can share that.
Okay, so you got Wi-Fi connection. It makes sense. You're just doing Wi-Fi at home. Summer Games 2016, so you must pay attention to the Olympics.
Not at all.
I didn't either. That's interesting.
I also haven't used Facebook much in the last 6 months either.
Independent. Frequent travelers. iPhone 5S. Do you have a 5S?
Yeah, I do.
It says right there. Of course, it knows because you're using that.
Yeah, well, when I
4G connection. Tablet owners. 4G US, Facebook page admins. Oh, you're an admin to a Facebook page. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, so a whole bunch of things that kind of allow you to isolate. Now, of course, those are very similar to what I was able to target when I put a GeekSpeak ad on Facebook, right? Well, I was able to say, I want to talk to these people that like 4G or whatever.
And this is exactly the purpose of this page, is to show you what ads you will see based on I should back up. But yes, these are the attributes of my account that are affecting what ads I see.
Cool. All right. Shall we move on? I want to invite people that have started listening to GeekSpeak recently, maybe through a web URL or whatever, to please subscribe to us via an RSS feed of some sort so that you get our shows regularly. It also allows us to figure out how many subscribers we have, helping us feel better about what we do, and also potentially pull on advertisers, I guess, if we do that.
Have you looked at our ratings on iTunes? I haven't looked in ages.
Oh, they're really good.
Yeah?
Yeah, like 4.5 stars with that. But if you haven't rated us on iTunes, please feel free to do that. That'd be awesome. Well, we're going to move on to kind of a larger form topic now. Maybe. I hope
we thought that was the larger form topic.
I really want to talk. Well, first, let's do it. Let's talk about Dropbox and hacking and macOS and software. But first, will you do a crazy USB the week for us, Miles?
Yes, for $56, you too can own a device that will destroy whatever you plug it into.
What do you mean destroy whatever you plug it into?
Meaning it has some high capacity or relatively so for the size capacity capacitors.
Okay.
And so there are USB on both sides. One is a male, one's a female.
Okay.
On the female side, if you plug that into your laptop, you will then charge up the capacitors on that device.
Okay.
At which point, if you plug it into some other device through the typical
USB.
You
plug another thing into it. Yeah.
Well, if you disconnect it, it'll hold that charge for some time.
And then you plug something into it.
Then you plug – it's like a USB key. You plug that into the USB slot on your laptop or on your TV or something like that, and it will discharge those capacitors immediately.
Frying everything.
Frying everything.
Frying the USB. I thought it was you charge it from your laptop, and then whatever you plug into it, it fries. Because it's got a male and female. So anyway, but in any case, the idea is a piece of the hardware.
Well, you need
destroys.
To find a way. You need a way to charge it up.
Right.
So that's where the female side is, where you charge it up from.
That's
great. You got to make sure that you go through the right end.
And the male side destroys everything,
as usual.
So wait a second. Is this sold as a security device? Because if your computer actually remains functional and it destroys the USB port, that means you can't have a bad USB hack into your computer.
Security device? No, this is weaponizing.
No, I'm serious. If you have no longer any USB ports that work on your machine, you're much more secure.
You assume that it just fries the USB ports. It could fry the whole power supply.
I don't assume. I did say if it survives.
If it survives, yes.
It depends on how well electrically isolated the USB chipset is from everything else in your system, which usually isn't going to be the case.
Not so much.
Yeah.
No.
Yes, but maybe it'll help Bluetooth headphones, right?
Is this actually being sold like in a real store?
$57,
you said, right?
I believe so. It's a Hong Kong-based company. And it's not exactly complex. I mean, it's 5 volts in.
Not so much 5 volts out. 50,000 volts out. Okay, cool.
Well, wouldn't it be 5 volts and just very high amperage? Or
If you want it to like jump circuits and stuff, you probably want to have high voltage. So
okay.
Probably a high voltage thing. It might be just a lot of current. But see, a lot of current providing a lot of current does not force a lot of current, right?
So that's true.
Depends on how you build the circuit. I guess you could have a resistor in there that sucks the – yeah, anyway. We won't get into electrical design right now.
By the way, that amount, that $56, that will also give you a test shield, so it'll allow you to test it without blowing up your own hardware first.
That's really good and important. Brian, you have a great story for us, a little adventure, if you will, about Dropbox. And first off, Dropbox, I use it. I actually pay for it. I like it. Are you going to tell me something that I'm not going to like about it?
Well, I don't know. Twitter told me something I didn't like about it. Last week, my Twitter feed blew up, and I didn't know what all these comments were about Dropbox hacking my Mac. This is specifically Dropbox on a desktop Mac or a laptop Mac, any Macintosh. So people are in up in arms because there were a few people looking into what Dropbox is doing and how it was using the admin privileges that it asks for when you install it, and what it was doing with those privileges were things that people didn't even expect were going on.
Dropbox specifically, if you don't use it on a Macintosh or on any system, basically allows you to duplicate data that's available in the cloud. So you have a folder on your computer called your Dropbox folder. You put a file in there, And then that the software that's running takes that file and puts it up in their service. And so later, if you don't even have your computer, you can go log into your Dropbox account, you can get that file, and you can download it. It's really great for sharing large files. Regularly, if I'm editing a file and I want to get some feedback on it, I'll put it up on Dropbox, I'll ask you or somebody else to look at it, and you can then view it on Dropbox. And the cool thing is the syncing capability. So simple text documents and stuff, it's very easy to edit from one location to the other and have them always be in sync. If you have two computers, it's great because the files are being moved around, copy all the time. All the Al Luckow, who's on the show regularly, and I are constantly working on Steve Wozniak's website. And the entire website, not the running website, but a copy of that and all the raw files and stuff are shared between the two of us through Dropbox so that it's and somebody else is participating so that it's very easy for us to manage that. So it's a great service in that regard.
Yeah, and you filled up the last of my hard drive pretty well when you shared some things with me too.
Sorry about that. That is one of the flaws of the system. As I share something with you, you don't know how big that is and it shows up it fills your Dropbox virtual space and also then downloads to your computer even if you didn't really intend to do that. So some settings you have to manage. But it does make sense that it has to have admin privileges because it's doing some pretty neat stuff. When it first started, we knew it was doing stuff that Apple wasn't even really designing it for it to do.
Yeah, you could say it's been hacking the system all along. But yeah. In recent versions, Apple has given hooks into the operating system so that it could display the badges on the icon to show this one is currently syncing or this one is already synced or this one isn't even in Dropbox.
And Google Drive uses that same feature set, right? So if you use Google Drive, it has a similar set where you can have a local copy even though they're not the actual file. They're more like a link to the file. But in any case, unless you have offline mode, in any case, they're using the same features. So Apple added those features because Dropbox was so successful.
Yeah, exactly. And Dropbox has been around since, 2004, 2005? I remember stories where Jobs was trying to offer to buy them back then before iCloud was made. So they have a long history. But, of course, over those intervening years.
2007, June 2007.
Oh, wow. A couple years newer than I
thought. Not bad, sir.
So in the intervening years, security has become much more of an issue. In fact, the previous operating system in a week, the current Mac operating system is locked down so much that there are certain files that the running system cannot modify at all. Mm-hmm. And now that Dropbox has the API for showing what files are synced and not, people assumed that it was not nearly as invasive and hacking the system as it was. But a lot of apps that Mac users use need hooks into the operating system that the app just can't take. Even with admin privileges, we didn't think they could take them. And what they do is they request, could you please go to the accessibility system preference and allow this app to use accessibility?
Here's an example. Accessibility is it needs a lot of more hooks to do things like look at what you're typing, right? So there's a level of inspection that an app can do, which is similar very much to things that are spying on you, right? And those feature sets are kind of protected, or we assumed are protected in such a way that you have to ask the system. Now, on your phone, the system is so locked down and everything goes through an app store, that is true that when you need to use the camera, the only way to actually do that is to request the system to ask the user to use the camera. Unless there's some kind of back door that the person's hacking on, and normally that's figured out in submission process and denied the service and maybe you even lose your account as a developer. So getting those permissions on a phone system is kind of absolute. On the desktop system, we've kind of expected it to be the same way.
Well, yeah, I guess our modern expectation. But somebody noticed, how do you say his name? It's Phyllis Stokes.
Okay.
Noticed that when Dropbox was installing and accessibility was open, that Dropbox would somehow force its way and get accessibility privileges without ever asking the user.
Normally, like I use key management software, like a thing called Spectacle, which allows me to have key commands that navigate my Mac. That's a big one that, you know,
move your windows around without actually moving the windows around with your mouse.
Exactly. And that needs permission. So every time I've installed that, and when it starts up, sometimes it says, hey, can I have access to your, or go do this and turn this on, and actually manually go over and switch it on. And so what he was seeing is, though Dropbox was asking for a password, it was never asking to be put into the accessibility area and enabled. Right. But it was being enabled automatically.
Right.
And that's weird.
And there is an official way that Apple gives developers to be able to do this, which is to request the user to go and turn it on. But there's also a command line utility that allows you to do that as well. And that you can't just run that with admin privileges and make it work. So there was something else that Dropbox was doing, and he looked into it, and there's a database, a SQLite database that actually holds this information of what apps are allowed to use accessibility and what aren't.
An SQL database is a very standard way of macOS development and iOS development to store local settings and things. It's very common, and it's always in the system. So that's not an unusual thing.
No, not at all. But there is official ways to change that database. And what Dropbox apparently was doing was going and making a manual change, not through the tool that's supposed to change the database, but they were going into the database itself when they were given admin privileges during the install to actually put in the record that says that Dropbox can be used in accessibility. This is totally outside of what any normal developer is supposed to be doing.
Right. Totally against the guidelines.
Yeah.
And at the same time, those guidelines are something that Apple recommends. So I'll play devil's advocate for a second. I think it's a little creepy that Dropbox did this. But from a devil's advocate perspective, I want the feature set, and they are doing what they need to make the feature set work for me. And, you know, yeah, sure, me turning on accessibility totally makes sense from the flow process. But as a software developer, I understand that every time you ask a user to do something, they might not do it, they might do it wrong, and then all of a sudden Dropbox doesn't work, and pretty soon a user can't use it, and it's all frustrating and hard. So to some degree, this made the process easier, and I did want the feature set, so they had to do it.
Yes, but there is the kicker.
What's the kicker?
The kicker is they don't need this at all.
What do you mean they don't need it at all? They don't need to get in the accessibility?
Yeah. They're inserting themselves in there because of a future need that they think they're going to have. But if you turn that off...
How do we know that they don't need that feature? Because they're doing a lot with Dropbox, the syncing automatically and updating the folders. I know that some of that's true, but maybe they're doing something else we're not aware that isn't available without that feature.
So there is a comment inside. This isn't the code. Where is this comment placed? It's
Can I actually kind of answer this? Because we're being kind of deceitful in the sense that I read this article too, got ticked off, and tried this out. And what I did is I stopped giving Dropbox the admin password. I erased it from my system, and then I went and deleted it from what is it we're talking about? They put themselves on
accessibility.
The accessibility pane. I removed the app, deleted the app, and then I reinstalled it, and I didn't give my admin password to Dropbox. And it said, you know, you need to, and I said no. And it's been working for me for 4 days with no problems at all. And if I restart it, it'll actually prompt me again, and I just say no again. And it's not inside the pane anymore because I'm not giving admin privileges, which means it doesn't even need admin privileges to work, which is phenomenal to me. I'm assuming that it's using my privileges as a user, not any admin privileges. So if I were to put like a root file with read only for root inside the Dropbox folder, they probably wouldn't be able to read it to copy it up because I didn't give it admin privileges, which is interesting. But so they don't need this feature. They don't need to be put in there at all. Why do you think that it's a future need? Why do you think they're doing it at all?
Why are they doing it at all? Well, you were saying exactly why is they're trying to make it so transparent to the user. To do whatever they want to be able to do to provide the files and sync the files.
Yeah, but they don't need this feature. I mean, obviously they don't need it. So why are they putting themselves in this position they don't need?
Honestly, I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, what you're saying is that the idea that make it as streamlined as possible, if in the future Apple does something like locks things down in a certain way or disables a feature or they want to add something, if they're in that setting, they can do anything the user can do and therefore they won't be blocked.
Right.
Miles, what do you think? Devious? You going to stop using Dropbox?
I never used Dropbox, as a matter of fact.
Why not? Because I'm superior to you?
No, I'd never had a need for it in the past. I had.
Oh, you worked at Google and had like Drive right away and like a terabyte of storage, right?
There was that. Didi, I remember getting Dropbox a long time ago.
Sure, she's always the first person to get stuff.
Yeah, and I just... When I thought of the amount of data that I wanted to have saved, the initial backup just put me off of doing anything like that for so long that I just put it off and put it off until finally I was like, hey, you know what? I don't feel like giving them to the cloud. I'm just going to make local backups. And
when I looked into this, I realized that a while ago I'd actually turned on the payment because I was dealing with the I was doing contract work, right? And so I started paying them. And that was because of, you know, the WAS site and another site and such. And I didn't realize that over time, the 20 megs, 100 megs, whatever, they're now giving me, I think, a terabyte of data storage. So I could put up most of my photo library and archive it with them. And it's not that expensive. It's not all my photo library. Therefore, it's not a complete sell. But it is impressive to think of that aspect, that they're providing something that's really useful. Because, of course, any day, all the stuff I carry could be destroyed or lost. And then I won't have my photos anymore, which would be sad to me.
Have you ever looked into using own cloud? You've got your new NAS and everything.
Yeah, well, I'm, of course, I do have two NASs at home with the data backed up, and I've got I've got a couple copies, and then I have another service that backs up my important photos, if you will. No, I haven't looked at OnCloud. Have you been looking at that?
Yeah, I look at it every once in a while. I used to run all these services on my own home server, and I gave it up like 8 or 9 years ago, and it's been so great not to have to do any maintenance ever since.
Well, what are you doing for your backup for your family photos and videos?
Oh, Time Machine, and yeah. On multiple Time Machines on multiple drives.
And you actually have two buildings, so do you have, like, because you have a two-house situation, so you have your NAS in two different buildings?
Yeah.
Oh, perfect.
No, the NAS in two? No, yeah. No, I've got one central place for the...
so a fire would take you out. Yeah.
But it's not in the house with the kids.
Okay. So it's safer.
Yeah, it must be safer.
Miles, what do you do for backup?
Time Capsule.
One copy?
Yes, although my the Time Capsule lives in my house, and I'm spending a whole bunch of time on my folks. So
so it's safer?
Yeah.
Yeah. The goats are guarding it. You know, it's so funny because for years, we've all the geeks have had NAS devices, and I've always thought we really should be doing rsync with each other, right?
Yeah.
And just so that if my drive goes away, there's a copy everywhere else. But you never finish up setting it up. Anyway, and, you know, online services are easy, and as we get paid better, as we grow up.
And aren't they more economical because you're only paying a little bit at a time?
Absolutely.
Meaning if you know what your storage needs are going to be and you pay upfront to get the hundreds of dollars to set up enough space that you could then share the space with your friends and you can all sync between the machines, I'm sure you can get the price down to something that makes sense over the course of years. But because nobody thinks that far ahead, it's going to be less expensive just to go ahead and pay the $9 a month or something like that.
Yeah, it's just a shame. Now this has me thinking of a business proposition that we don't have more of a setup that is personal. Like you have a sibling and you both get 5 terabyte drives, for example, and then you're Thanksgiving, you get together and then you sync those drives together.
This is what I'm talking about. Exactly. Yeah, we do that.
But with ZFS, it's something that has snapshotting and checksumming on the file system so that when you go to opposite ends of the planet, wherever you live, that when they're doing that sync, that it happens very fast and very space efficient and you're not bogging down the
– And reliably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Netflix should be the only thing that bogs down your internet connection.
Dang right. So make that startup, man. That sounds great.
It's interesting. Of course, now I've given my business plan to everyone out there. So
it's all open source anyways. Yeah. You just have to cobble together a few open source things.
I think Miles, that idea is worth about 25 cents.
Yeah.
But the implementation would be priceless. Hey, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. Use our stuff any way you'd like. Just let them know we said hello. Thanks to our patrons very much. If you'd like to be a patron and help us out, please visit geekspeak.org/support. Plus, our intern Chandler and our support geek Greg Merkley, thank you so much for today's working title, Bill. That's not the right title.
No, he wasn't around. He was traveling.
Miles, quick, a title for today's show.
The title for today's show is...
quick, I'll throw back a whole bunch of titles. Doom, Burrito Drones, Legal Software, Facebook deletes the photos with children screaming in pain. Crazy USBs, electric shock, Dropbox hacks.
Facebook's USB causes legal doom.
Oh, that was really good.
I hope you recorded that.
Yeah. Legal, okay, I'll look at it later. Also, thank you, Michael Newman of PetStar Music, for providing our theme song. And thank you for being here for episode 38 of season 16. Anything we didn't cover, gentlemen? By the way, we do a post show like this because we're done officially, and you're welcome to go say goodbye.
But news gets stale, so news we either talk about it now or we don't talk about
it
at all.
We let it go, and so now what we do is we kind of record some extra, but in no way are you obligated to keep on listening.
You mean there's people out there that think they have to listen right now?
It feels like it. We get feedback like you guys are rambling at the end. I'm like, yeah, because it already ended.
Yeah, these are the B-list headlines.
So we put the meat up front, and then this is like the dessert after course.
Because bandwidth is cheap, you know?
And so, our time is cheap, right?
So because of the recent debacle with Samsung's Galaxy Note 7.
What was the debacle? Oh, yeah, it burst into flame?
Yes, they've been exploding.
Yes, I read about it.
That'd be bad usually, on an airplane.
Yeah, usually when they're being charged.
Yeah.
And
which means when you're not by it, it starts on fire. Not good.
When it's unattended.
Well, no. It's a lot of times, like, I'll have my phone plugged in while I'm looking at it because, you know, it's almost running out of power, but I'm right in the middle of that very important Facebook session. So the thing about it, though, is airlines, the FAA has stated that they're not banning Galaxy Note 7s. They are recommending that people not charge them or use them on the flight.
So if they're not being charged, is it possible for them to burst into flames?
I'm sure it is possible, but it's less likely. If you're not actively using one, then obviously the CPU isn't working as hard, the GPU isn't working as hard, the heat sources aren't going to be as prevalent. Charging it on the plane, yeah, you just need to not do that. but so
we've got all of the dangers off of the plane, right?
All right. But the pithy thing about all of this is that Galaxy Note 7s are still allowed on planes, but more than 3.1 ounces of shampoo, strictly forbidden.
That's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
Exploding phones are considered less dangerous than shampoo.
Are nail clippers still disallowed? Yeah, these modern flying rules have killed me. I don't care pocket knives anymore.
Yeah, 15 years later after 9/11, when all these rules came about, perhaps it's time to revisit.
Yeah.
Speaking of batteries and exploding, I want to tell you an embarrassing thing that happened to me recently.
Oh, this could be good.
So you guys know what a lithium ion battery of 18650 looks like? Do you know what it looks like? It's larger than an AA. It's wider and taller. And it's rechargeable, and they're great, and they're very popular. Not here, and so if you
the kind of a flat brick.
No, these are round. These are round. But actually, very commonly, two of these together is what's a pack that's inside your rechargeable phone or something.
Okay.
Oh, those ones. Okay. Yeah. Was it a CR something?
It's a CR18650. 50.
Yeah, these are all over cameras.
That's right. They're all over cameras as packs normally, doubles. And then also you can buy them individually. When you buy like a really inexpensive laser pointer from China, that's the battery they're in. I do that a lot, by the way. I give laser pointers to people because they're freaking fun.
You buy them cheap from China, right?
Yeah. And they're almost always broken. I have to resolder them and stuff. It's really fun. Anyway, there's also a battery that's half the size of that. I don't remember what it's called. Now, normally, these batteries are lithium-ion batteries. Lithium-ion batteries are rechargeable, unless they're not. And you can also buy these where they're not rechargeable. So, I had a flashlight.
I have this like...
Yes. I have a laser pointer that I'm using at night, or I want to recharge it. So, I have a charger for the 18650. And I also have a charger for the smaller one, which I don't actually have any rechargeable batteries for. I have a rechargeable battery. Anyways, I had a laser pointer that was using the shorter one, and I was like, and it ran out. So I'm like, oh, I should probably just, you know, recharge this. So I threw in the charger, and then I'm going out and about, and then I was like, oh, yeah, and it's been there for a while. Oh, it's time to pull that out because they charge quick. So I throw that battery. Gosh, it's kind of warm. And I throw it in my laser pointer, and I turn the laser pointer on, and I go outside, and I'm playing with it. And I'm actually looking for something as a flashlight with this thing. And I have it up next to my face.
Dude, I feel like the guy with the scream mask is walking behind you now, just waiting for this to come.
It's late at night by myself. It exploded in my hand like an M80. It was so loud. The aluminum can did not discharge. It didn't break. But it shot the lens and the entire battery and LED out the front, and I'd never found it. It was gone. And the insides of the battery just exploded out like a flower. And it was definitely like so much that my ears are ringing and it was really scary. Maggie, who was asleep at the time, runs out of the house going, what happened? Neighbor came like, what's going on? So do not recharge a battery that's not rechargeable. That's a stupid, stupid thing to do.
That's so all. Says the guy with a certificate in electronics.
Oh, I realized the rechargeable one was for a laser pointer. This was a flashlight. The flashlight blew up. That's why I was using it to see things. But it was for – see, I get confused myself, and that's why I almost lost my sight. The other thing is
– kind of flashback into flashlight.
The other thing is I was taking that flashlight commonly and putting it so that my eyesight was over the tip of it because I'm looking for rodents in my yard and stuff, and the eyes will reflect if you shine it right at them. So it was just coincidental that it didn't – the sparks didn't fly out in my eye.
This is horrifying. Mm. Not that you getting hurt. I don't care
about that.
No, you
don't care about that.
I ask you for electronics advice all the time.
Yes, but I don't give you that advice when I've had a bourbon late at night. I normally do it to you like right after work.
Yeah, but you'll program it that time, right?
Don't drink and charge batteries.
Don't drink and charge batteries. All right. That was the battery story. Are we done with that one?
Yeah. Sure.
Brian, what do you got?
Oh, I just love this song. Warner Brothers, they have a service that they use to claim whenever there is their own copyrighted material online illegally. And this service that they use went ahead and tagged a number of their own properties and their own site as being illegal purveyors of Warner Brothers.
Warner Brothers gave himself a cease and desist?
And yes. They sent this to Google, and Google had to decide what to do with this.
What do you mean Google had to decide what to do?
Well, they actually put some thought into it, and they decided not to remove these links on Amazon, IMDb, Sky Cinema that were all Warner Brothers properties.
Okay, that's beautiful. So basically they had a bot that was looking for their content.
Well, it's not,
and their bot didn't have good filters to stop when it was their content.
It's this service that they use. And this service obviously has a bot that does all this. But yeah, and Torrance Freak is the one that figured this out. And the service is called Vobile. I think I got that right. And they submit hundreds, thousands, millions of these links constantly to Google to remove from Google search so that Google is not contributing to copyright infringement. They took a look at Google took a look at this and decided not to remove those links.
It's just great.
There have been 10 million Raspberry Pis sold thus far. I bought four of them. And
oh, wait, by the way, you earlier today showing me a Postgres database and a search of index that you're running from my office in Los Gatos from your Raspberry Pi in Ben Lomond or Scotts Valley, whatever, yeah. Was really friggin' cool.
Oh,
I did not understand that when you were running that query, you were running off of a Raspberry Pi in your private network. So kudos to you to being super cool.
Oh,
go on.
Okay. I was thinking, like, how insecure am I? Raspberry Pi connected directly to the internet.
I thought you paid attention to last week's episode and knew exactly how to do it with you. You haven't bought one of these units, have you?
No, I haven't.
So I got to say, Lyle, last week's show, that was awesome because my router was dying at the same time. My router that controls half of my property's Wi-Fi was making my wife really mad that she couldn't watch her, her videos.
Did you get Ubiquiti EdgeRouter X?
So, yeah, I got the EdgeRouter X, which I haven't set up yet.
Yeah.
I've been playing around with it.
Well, after talking to Alex, I haven't set mine up correctly yet.
Well,
either.
Alex offered to be online while I'm doing this. I didn't even know when I was going to play with it. I was waiting for Xcode to install on my machine. But I did put the access point up. And the access point itself.
Oh, they're great.
That's awesome.
Oh, yeah, the great access points.
So if you put two of those access points up, they will communicate with each other and communicate users as well? Or do you have to have a third device?
No. The user management system happens in the software you run on your machine. And then as you add a device, it adds all that data to that device. And then your machine can be shut down. So the management of them is all through your – yeah, it's pretty cool.
But it's awesome. I could have like groups on the access points for me and my wife and my kids. And I can just say all those kid devices – they don't have access to Wi-Fi
after
a certain period of time.
Absolutely.
And it knows between the two access points.
Yeah. And when you define clients and stuff, you can actually also specify hardware IPs and all that. I mean, that's all just part of the Wi-Fi package that exists in Ubiquiti's Wi-Fi management software.
A lot of firmware allow you to do that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So DDWRT doesn't have a nice interface to be able to do that with. Now,
Yeah, well, that's kind of.
I mean, you can do it manually. I've done it manually.
But the edge router also does this, right? So you need to move. Are you serving your DHCP through the edge router right now?
Currently, it's still going through my Buffalo router, okay. Which is DDWRT.
So the one thing that's a little tricky is that the Wi-Fi access points do not connect as well as I'd like to the Ubiquiti edge router stuff. So they're kind of separate entities.
Right.
That's okay. Anyway.
Anyways, after years and years and years on DDWRT, which the interface is terrible, but it has so many features on there that I love. After years of that, using this thing was just a dream.
Yeah, I know.
That's the thing. DDWRT, the interface may be terrible, but they're replacing the manufacturer's firmware, which was so much worse.
Which is why the last router I bought, I brought pre-installed with the DDWRT on it.
Lazy.
Yeah. Have to say installing DDWRT is not, I won't call it fun. It's not necessarily hard, but it's not fun.
Did you have like a DOS floppy? I feel like it's like those old days.
Well, no, no. You're hooking up screen and you're dumping data directly to it. Or no, that was...
Oh, it depends. It depends on the hardware.
I'm sorry. No, I'm thinking of something else. I had a little...
No, but it does depend on the hardware, how you actually interact with the hardware, right? Because you sometimes have to like install a special serial over USB type.
First you have to like reset the firmware to the manufacturer's firmware to the right thing. Then you have to do a... what they call a 30-30-30 or something like that, where it's like you hold down the reset button and then you turn the power off and then you turn the power on all while holding down the reset button.
The instructions on how to do this are always available and they're always being kind of updated. And once you do install WDRT on an old router, then it will be auto-updated. I mean, it's really cool.
You can it's solid after that.
I mean, if you've got an old router and you don't want to spend money to get a new router – or Wi-Fi access point, whatever kind of hardware. Take a look to see if WDRT or Tomato, one of those packages, can be installed on it. Definitely get away from the manufacturer one because the manufacturer ones also have really bad vulnerabilities, right? Mm-hmm. If you haven't updated your router, you've got
even,
a problem.
Even if you have, their software can be so bad that there's vulnerabilities that are being discovered all the time.
Now, the Wi-Fi access point that you got from Ubiquiti is not the $50 home, you know, the edge router we talked about last week. It's more like $100.
No, it's an $80.
$80 access point.
AC standard.
AC?
Did I get that right? AC. Yeah. AC is the gigabit, right? So AC. So it's got both a 2.5 and
Wi-Fi AC.
Wi-Fi AC. It's got 2.5 and 5 gigahertz radios on it, so it can do the whole spectrum of Wi-Fi. You know, B.
Too bad we don't live a little closer. We could connect our networks together.
we could, but the performance I'm getting out of this is incredible. We run two iPhones to connect the houses as far as audio goes so that we can hear what's going on in either house.
What's the software you use on those iPhones?
It's a baby monitor software.
Okay.
I've never had
my
such
goodness,
a...
I've never even thought about doing that. I have like a ton of iPhones. Just like, my God, I'm like kicking myself. You have no idea.
It's the only way. Our kids live in a different house than I do.
If you need an old iPhone, too, I've got an iPhone 1 you can have, too.
Dude, I have. I have an iPhone.
What's your excuse,
I have
an
iPhone 3G, a 3GS.
And you have a child. What's wrong with you? Why aren't you doing that?
I lack imagination.
Lack imagination?
But your houses are very close together. But, of course, you have Wi-Fi connecting them. That's easy.
I mean, I have Ethernet connecting them. Okay. But I have Wi-Fi in both houses. And, of course, you can't put Ethernet into a iPhone 4.
Not very easily, no.
No. So, actually, I should look into what I can do. Anyways, the connection I'm getting is so solid now. It's just beautiful.
Oh, it never drops.
Oh, yeah. No. I used to get these little hiccups. Remember – a year ago, we did a show where I was trying to map my whole Wi-Fi.
Yes, I remember that. Just to find the
Noise. I was getting terrible dropouts on that all the time. And I fixed that by improving the sort of radio space of my property. But now this has just cleared it up completely.
So, to be clear, you know the studio on the property that I'm on? The other building?
Yeah.
There's a hop to that. There's an access point on the outside of that that connects to my dining room. And then those two together and the one in Gwen's room or Gwen's side of that go to the pool. Like, that's how far the Wi-Fi access points go, the outside on it.
So I've got, what standard are you using?
I can't recall. I think I've got two on.
Anyways, just replacing this old router I was using for that with an $80 access point, which doesn't require anything else. It can work on its own.
Yes.
Was awesome.
Yeah. All right. It feels like Ubiquiti's paying us.
I know, but I'm really excited about it. It's nice. I like using it.
Miles, you got two more.
One of the ways now to control a populace, in the past you had German Stasi, you know, just have your neighbors spy on each other and the like.
Sure.
But now we have surveillance ability within our infrastructure that is kind of chilling. in some ways and does need some oversight. But one thing that one report found was that governments around the world are denying internet access to any political opponents.
Ooh.
And if you're, you know, if you're either a minority party or you're a dissident or whatever, and you can't, you don't have any internet access, you can't get your message out.
You don't have a voice.
You have no voice.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like in this day and age, the idea of free speech kind of equates to internet access.
Yeah, it's they're almost synonymous now. It's kind of like, you know, 30 years ago and you didn't have a telephone or a mailbox.
Right.
It's
you're silent.
Yeah. I mean, you could go out of your way and try to find some way to get a message out, but you can't do that for your day-to-day basis, and it's not going to be easy to hide.
Ryan, Microsoft Golden Key?
Microsoft, a little bit more than a month ago, there was a story about a Golden Key being discovered in their software that would allow any hacker to get past Secure Boot.
Secure Boot.
Thank you.
The BIOS level protection of hardware.
And the tech media totally ran with this because the hackers that discovered this, they actually have a political agenda, which I agree with, which is about how, see, if you put a master key into or a backdoor into software, see FBI, somebody's going to be able to discover it and break through the defenses that are supposed to keep us secure.
I'm hearing a but in here.
Yeah, there is a but because it wasn't actually true. One of the podcasts we both listen to, Security Now, Steve Gibson was the only person I've seen that actually challenged this assumption. And he went through and explained why this was not a golden key. In fact, it is a very clever hack that allows people running a previous older version of the UEFI Secure Boot Manager get around the Secure Boot and take control of the machine. But this was all coming about because Microsoft was allowing had updated the boot manager, and it would allow you to be able to run test software
on an older version, on older operating systems, older BIOS.
The mechanism for doing this is on the newer boot manager.
Okay.
But you could exploit it, and on the old boot manager that didn't understand this new system, you could break through and get around Secure Boot.
They basically, by releasing this new feature set in Secure BIOS, they killed old hardware as being non-secure anymore.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Which is not as much a concern, unless, of course, you have that old BIOS.
Well, yeah, but of course, everybody recommends to keep up to date with updates. This update came with the Windows 10 Anniversary Edition.
But would this be update your BIOS as well? Well, I thought the problem was that the BIOS was still burnt in. You couldn't actually
I did want to bring up that whole, like, because you should be updating your BIOS. Audience members out there, when was the last time you updated a BIOS on your laptop or computer?
So this is the Secure Boot Manager. Boot. I can't talk tonight.
It's boot. It's like on your
boot.
Foot.
Mm-hmm. Boot manager.
Pulling yourself up by your bootstraps.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's the Secure Boot Manager. And when you install Windows 10 Anniversary Edition, you get the latest one and you are protected from this flaw.
Okay. That's good to know. I didn't know that it updated the hardware. Okay. Miles, Brian, thank you so much for being here today.
Always a pleasure.
That was a blast.